Hello there.
Hello, Joe.
I like greeting you as if we weren't just talking.
Well, we weren't. We only discussed like the vagrancies of having to fight sunlight through windows.
Right. That's right. The
It's
struggle.
summer. It's New England. The summer
Yeah.
is here.
I think somebody compared it to like the eclipse was like turning the lights off and turning them back on and everything got warm again. Like I feel like that is definitely the case. Like spring has sprung. Like this is a new whole, like new spring, new me. I'm all about it.
Yeah, my sister and all my other kind of astrology friends are telling me that it was literally like one of those moments where,
No.
where things were and now they're not, or they
Oh, I'm into
will
that.
be
Okay.
at the beginning and the becoming. So, yeah.
I'm into this.
Okay, so today we're going to talk about something a little bit different. I want to change things up a lot because we've had different kinds of conversations. We've had conversations where we've talked about our experiences with running agencies, client services, selling product, all that kind of stuff. And then we've also talked to other people. We've had some real like rock stars, Tracy and John, and last week we did Jay. We've had some amazing people talking about their businesses, how they became agency owners, how they decided to get out of the agency business, or maybe that decision was made for them. And
Yeah.
I'm still getting like weekly inbounds from people saying, should I start an agency? Or I'm currently running an agency or a client services businesses. What should I do about it? Or will you be an advisor to that business? And it's a tension question for me. It's a high tension question for me because on the one hand, that's what I did for like 15 years, or services, actually service businesses for even longer than that. And that's what we talk about. And on the other hand, I don't like the agency business in its aggregate. In other words, like
Huh? I got
the
it.
average,
Yeah.
agency is not appealing to me. And when somebody comes to me and says, hey, I'd like you to be on our advisory board or even join us in some other role or position to help us grow this business. When I look at the fundamentals, I'm like, I don't really like this business. This is not a business I would get into. I would not invest in this business. And so I wanted to talk a little bit about today about what is the playbook for an agency in 2024. In other words, could there be such a thing as a playbook? And if there is such a playbook, could you actually go and execute on that? I mean, having a playbook is one thing. Is there a market for this stuff that you can go and make real? And so I went for a very long walk this morning and I made a list of all the things that I would put into that playbook. Essentially, like a canvas, like a imagine a business canvas where you say, what are the things that need to be true in order for me to get into this business? And what I did is I turned the dial all the way up to kind of 11. I was like, okay, what's the extreme version of that?
I like that.
And then so I thought what I'd do today is I'd introduce what is the ideal situation playbook canvas for an agency to exist today. And then what we can do is as we kind of go through these things, we can also just dial that back and say, okay, let's add a little bit of reality to this. In if you're an existing agency and you're already dealing with certain situations, could you dial it up, or could you introduce something, or could you just stop doing something in order to be closer to that ideal? So what I want to start with is, and this is if the listeners are going to be worried about taking notes, I will eventually publish this list, probably on LinkedIn or something. But I want to go through a list of things in no particular order that I think need to be addressed or made real in order for an agency to be something useful or something profitable or something that has value. In other words, my criteria for this is it creates value, and also so it's creating value in the sense that it's making something useful to the customer, their customer, the client. And it's also creating value for the people that are there. Because what I often find it, and the reason why I got to that as being like the value equation, if you will, or the algebra, is that what I see is a lot of agencies doing good work, really good work for their clients, but they're struggling. Like the agencies are struggling. Like the owners aren't taking a lot of money. They've been doing it for a while, and they're just like, "Hey, man, this has to get better. Otherwise, you know, my partner's going to shoot me, or I'm going to run out of money to pay for my kids." So it has to be, we're making something valuable, and we're also getting value out of it, so that it's not just a zero sum game. It's not like, oh, we just made a bunch of stuff, and we're crapping out.
Yeah,
we're not getting anywhere.
Yep.
Does that sound like a fun conversation to have today?
It does. And I think it's, you know, one of those weird kismet things that tends to happen with the two of us, where just yesterday I posted on LinkedIn a snapshot of the Happy Cog website from 2011 when I started there, because I was unearthing what had been the Happy Cog contact form to reach out and connect about a project. And it's very telling. I only bring that up because it's very of its time. It's very telling. There's a lot of just like idiosyncrasy to it. It was fascinating. Like there was a 60 question PDF that you had to fill out as your project planner for someone at Happy Cog to return your call. Like you would go to the Happy Cog site. Okay. The first sentence was, "We're really excited to hear from you." The second sentence was, "Most projects start at $100,000. And then there was a downloadable PDF. You filled out 60 questions. I'm not exaggerating. I counted.
That's awesome.
And it's just like, it's a relic of that time. And it's from a different era of when this stuff was a different kind of industry. But at the same time, to your point, I think it is also emblematic of a business that was operating that way. A business that at that time was generating a lot of value for the owner, generating a lot of value for the clients, generating a lot of value for the team. You know, the people that worked there were getting a lot out of it. And that's the kind of like city on a hill that I walked into when I started there. And I had the privilege of seeing that, and I am indexed towards that. And like you, like, I feel like those are kind of the only agencies I would run, or I want to be involved in, or I want to help people achieve. I think that I think we're in a world where you can be a business if you are in the, you know, the vast majority of like average, maybe average thinking, average value creating, average kind of agencies like that. And I think that there's a lot of agencies that comfortably fit into that category, but they're the ones who are, you know, stressing about payroll every week, wondering why are they doing this anymore. There's a lot of agencies that are in that kind of, it's a unique kind of hell where you're doing good work, but you're not being wonderfully rewarded for it. Or you're doing good work and you have a team you love and you're whatever. There's like a tension there that's very hard. And I'm the same way. Like in my consulting, if I am vetting somebody that I'm going to do biz dev consulting with, and I detect that they are very much trying to play from what I call like the muggle playbook of like how to be a very typical agency, my interest and enthusiasm goes right out the window. Like I'm just buy a book. You could buy a book. If you want to just do like C+ things, there's lots of books that'll give you C+ ideas. You know, where I get excited is when I just had a call. I had a call with an agency that you and I both know that's like considering doing some consulting, run by someone that we admire, that like fucking like I want to help you. It's like what Jay said last week too. It's kind of timely to that. We were talking about how you go from 0 to 90 and 90 to 100 is much harder, and staying at 100 is really hard.
Yeah.
And you're talking
about, incredibly difficult.
Yeah. The kind of agency you're talking about is the kind of agency ideally that's like staying at 100. It's figured out a way to kind of operate at 199, 98, back up to 100, like, but not operating at 65 and not operating at 32. But like, what are the perfect elements? What are the combination of things that need to exist for you to run an agency to exist that operates at that kind of level? I agree that there are things. I'm really wonderfully curious, like what your list is. I'm sure like there will be brilliant things in there, and there will be some things in there that you and I definitely are aligned on. But I'm just, yeah, I think it's a great idea. And I think it is truly one of the things that I think plagues a lot of the people that you and I know, and likely the listeners of this podcast, besides my mom, who does not care about that. But she would listen, you know, if we were talking about the 76ers. So it doesn't really matter.
We love you, Mom.
That's right.
Okay. So again, I want to disclaim this as, this is perfect modeling, perfect playbook. Right. And it's quite extreme in the sense that people are going to find it difficult to do everything in the playbook. Right. But the but is, or maybe it's an and, the but is, I think if you do this, you will find success, some kind of success. You will create value in the market for yourself and for the team,
yeah,
and for the customer or the end you, that sorry, the client that you're giving, you know, your services to. So the first part of the playbook, or let's just say that let's start with the canvas. Imagine you've got like three elements. You've got the team being probably the most important part of that. You've got the business model being the second part of it. And then you've got the things that incentivize both the team and the model. So if you think about this as a canvas, you've got those three elements. They're not separate. They're all connected. But it's not like a flywheel connected. It's, if you have a model and you have a team and you build the right environment, in other words, the right incentives, then you will make money. Simple as that. Okay. So let's start with the team. And again, these are in not any particular order, but when we were running Fertile Soil, I spent a lot of time thinking about the team dynamic, the size of the team, what makes a good team, what makes a bad team, a lot of those kinds of things. I went on to write books, as you know, about that particular thing and how they operate. And my day-to-day work continues to be about that. I keep asking questions about what is a healthy dynamic for a team. And so I want to start with some of the real fundamentals. If you have an agency, you have to have a reasonably small team. So this is hard for a lot of companies because they want to be big and they want to make a lot of money. They associate team size,
yes, yes,
with,
yes,
money size.
With money size.
And those, yes, two things can be connected, but they shouldn't be connected. And I'll get back to the specifics of what I think needs to happen. The reason why the team needs to be small is because the team needs to operate as a single organism. If you've got too many silos and too many things going on, you lose transparency, you lose alignment, you start to get problems with communication, culture breaks down, all of those things. So the ideal team size is probably closer to 30, like 25 to 30. But it could be slightly bigger or it could be slightly smaller than that. But it's in that range where you could literally, if you were in a physical office, you could look around and see everybody, make eye contact with everybody. So there's that. That's that one thing. Now, why is this important? Well, when I was researching this, I saw that there were all kinds of high performance teams. And I put that in, you know, quotations, like high performance teams that were healthy, whether they were sports teams, or if you were looking at SEAL teams or any other model of a team. And there is a certain amount of human capacity or brain cognitive capacity to do the work of socializing and relationship building that starts to get really, really problematic at a certain team size.
Right. It gets stressed and strained. Yeah.
It's possible to do it with 100 or even more people. It's definitely possible. Yeah. But I'm saying for an agency, you want to create as much of a high density version of that where you can literally look around and see everybody, assuming you're in an office. If you're remote, that's different. But everybody should be able to get on a Zoom call and you should be able to make eye contact with everybody. This is the second part of this is going to be really difficult for people to swallow. And John Lax and I had this argument the very first time we met with each other at that owner camp that you invited me to. I think we met at Was it the one in Boulder? I'm not at Boulders in Arizona.
That's Scottsdale. Boulders. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah, was that it? I think that was it.
Huh.
So I believe in a very long tenure. I believe in a very long commitment. So the owners of the business and the people that they're recruiting to the business should be recruited under the assumption that they're going to be there for a long time. And I'll explain what that means in a little bit more detail in a second. But the longer the tenure, the better. So 10 plus, so we're looking at about 12 to 15 years where you're going to commit to this organization. You're going to commit to this team. Why is that important? I think that when you commit very long term to something, there's a whole different set of behaviors and incentives that show up.
Sure.
Kind of like having a kid. You're like, I'm kind of in this for the next, you know, 18 years at least, maybe more. But like for the very, very least, like I'm owned by this. This thing owns me. I've made a commitment to it.
Because stability is a competitive advantage.
Stability is a competitive advantage. But the kind of relationships that develop during that time are a significant competitive advantage.
Right.
Because you are able to do things that other teams can't do.
Yeah.
And the momentum is exponential. Like teams that work together get better at working together. There's also an institutional set of knowledge, so a data set, if you will, that gets increasingly more valuable over time. I'm sure there's some degradation at the end of that, like the early stage, like, gee, maybe the 10-year-old data isn't as significant. But working together and building something together has a significant advantage when you've been doing it for a long time. Okay, so the idea behind that, or the playbook title of that, would be start together, stay together, finish together. I'll come back to the finish together thing in a second, because I think it's a thing that a lot of agency owners are going to break out in hives in if I put that in too early. I got to kind of tease them through this before we get to that. And really what you want to try and do is get people to see this as the most important work that they will ever do. In other words, they may be unemployable at the end of this, just like we heard from Jay last week. When you get to a long stretch, how long did he run his business for? I can't remember.
Full Stop was probably less than 10 years, but, you know, close to.
Yeah. It generally, by the way, it all happens, if you speak to any of these owners, there's that kind of magic between 10 and 15 years. There's that magic period. By making that commitment, you are also deciding to do something that's really, really important. And that is, I'm not going to do anything else. So during this period of time, this is all I'm going to do. So the focus is really critical. But there's a secondary focal thing that comes out of that, or focusing thing that comes out of that, forcing function, if you will, that says, if you do this for a long period of time, there's a really good chance that you could be super successful and you may develop skills that will make you unemployable in the traditional sense. In other words, you won't necessarily be looking for another job.
Right.
You may go into other kinds of work that this long period of work was essentially credentialing you to do. So that could be consulting, could be advising, could be board roles, could be any kind of thing. Or it might mean that you just go into some kind of early retirement, like Craig said during his interview. Yeah. Like he's got this like thin sliced idea of what a retirement looks like. So if anybody wants to know more about that, go back and listen to the Craig Bryant interview that we did. And so what that means is the team is committing to, it's almost like an NDA. They're like signing, saying, look, I'm going to be part of this and we're going to make what we do proprietary, in the sense that we're going to work together. We're going to, I wouldn't say harbor our secrets, but we're going to keep the work that we do, the process that we do, the secret of the organization. And so you see very successful businesses doing this. And it's really, it's a borrowed idea, in that A, yes, you are keeping what makes you work secret, but B, it's the mythology that's created around that that's almost more important. So, you know, people say, wow, you know, Apple is a really secret organization, or you know, Renaissance investing was a really kind of secret organization. Really, there's a mythology associated with that, as if you're now wondering, gee, what do they know that I don't know?
Yeah.
And it gives them an edge, right?
Yeah. This is what IDEO had going for it in its heyday, was the whole, the mythology was more powerful than the reality.
Yeah. Now, yep. I want to put a note here that, again, we'll come back to, and that is, this can only be sustained for a certain amount of time. It's probably not possible to keep that level of mythology alive forever. Right. In other words, it works for a long time, but it can't work necessarily forever. And so that's why I've said kind of 10 to 15 years is that general time period, not just for an employee's tenure, but for the existence of the company. And again, I said, I'll come back to the finish line soon. Okay. I'll make a point of coming back to that. The other part of team building. So we're still on teams. Just remember that, like those three things. The teams have to be made up of primarily very, very smart people. Okay. So these are higher than average intelligence individuals, and they show higher than average EQ as well. So their emotional intelligence is high. Now, that doesn't mean you can't have junior people, and I'll get to the junior people in a second, but you want a high proportion of very, very, very smart people, because the kind of work you're going to be doing if you're an agency is you're going to be thinking about other people's problems on a day-to-day basis. Clients are going to come to you and say, hey, we're a pharmaceutical company. We've got this problem doing this. We need to solve this problem. And you're going to have to go from 0 to 100 in a very short space of time. So intelligence is a really, really important part of the agency model. And having really intelligent people on the team also helps you avoid just making kind of the dumb errors that will, you know, ambush the whole thing. So, you know, what you want to be is, again, less stupid or less dumb. But really, the thing is, you want to have a certain amount of, I was going to say predictability, but it's not that. It's like you want a certain amount of intelligence in the organization that will prevent you from making the obvious mistakes. Right. Okay. So obvious is probably a better word. Like, there are a lot of obvious mistakes that agencies make, a lot of obvious mistakes that businesses make. You want people who are smart and mature and just generally aware enough that they're not going to make those kinds of mistakes. So what's the problem with that? Well, they're an expensive commodity.
Like, yeah.
Smart people are expensive.
Right. But they are, to your previous point, similarly stabilizing. They make the business stable over a 10 to 12. They immunize you from sitting on your own keys and hurting yourself in a stupid way, stepping on a rake and it's snapping up and hitting your face. Like, if they can avoid those things, there is a stabilizing effect to not doing those silly things.
Right.
Yeah.
As I think it was Charlie Munger who said, it's way easier to be less dumb than to be smart all the time.
Right.
And I just think that having smart people allows you to be less dumb.
Right.
Like, it's just, generally, people are asking better questions. They're showing up with more maturity and intelligence and
yes, all that kind of stuff. They raise the ceiling and raise the floor.
Yeah. Now, small sidebar, but part of this conversation is that, and we just actually were posting about this on LinkedIn now, because we had this conversation with Jay the other day, and that is, an apprenticeship program is an essential part of that team. Mm-hmm. So here's why. You do want junior talent. And you do want to bring smart people in, but you may not be able to afford 20 really, really, really expensive smart people. So you may need to bring some junior folks in through an apprentice program and guide them or ramp them into that. So you're leveraging the fact that they're really smart and emotionally intelligent, but they just don't have the skills yet.
Right. Less
so the apprenticeship program is giving them the skills.
Yeah.
The other part of an apprentice program is there is a little bit of indoctrination there, in the sense that you can teach young people how to do the work that you want to be done in the manner in which you want done versus them bringing bad habits from other companies. And 100%. So what we see time and time again is, take young, impressionable, lovely, brilliant humans
yeah.
who've already got all the skills that they need from their genetics or from their parents,
mm-hmm.
in the sense that the skills you were going to be teaching them are hard skills, like, you know, how to write code or how to push pixels or whatever.
You're not teaching them EQ. You're not, they're built with that.
No, no, you can't.
Right.
You can't. Like, you can, but it's going to take too much time and it's not really your job.
100%.
So it's much better to, you know, when during that interview process, seek out those individuals that have those, you know, the soft skills that we call, I mean, I don't know why we call them soft skills, but the skills that are like, this is a kind person, this is a compassionate person, this is an intelligent person, this is somebody with social awareness, empathy, like they just have it. Like, it doesn't need to be like a DEI focused thing and like, oh, we have to take these people and mold them into these people. It'd be like, no, we just like, they are just good people. And it doesn't matter what color, creed, or whatever they are. It's just like, they're good people. And that's the kind of the no arseholes or no bullshit rule. It's like, just don't hire an arsehole because they've got credentials. Like, rather hire somebody with no credentials, but they're an amazing person. And then you teach them the things you want. So the apprentice program is a crucible, essentially, of taking these wonderful humans, but they're young, and then you can bring them into an organization that they're going to get paid slightly less because, you know, they don't have the skills. You're going to teach them the skills. As an apprentice, they're going to be doing both client work and they're also going to be learning these skills. So about 50-50, we can talk about apprentices another time, but the way that we worked it was about 50% client work, 50% they're doing their own studying work and under a master, under one of their leaders. And then they're developing those hard skills to be able to go and do the work that we want them to do. So that's how you balance it out between having probably about 50% really, really senior, mature people and 50% people who are coming up through the ranks. I mean, we recruited them straight out of school. We like them young. We like them impressionable. It's not that they were just saying yes to everything. They were asking hard questions. They were pushing back. But they didn't have the hard skills. They weren't. They didn't know how to make a digital product yet.
Yes, and they're born speaking the language as opposed to having to learn a foreign language. So they're much more fluent in the language. If that's the only language you ever spoke and you were raised speaking that language, you're fluent. Whereas if you have to learn the language, that's harder. So I think the Montero has a great angle on this too. Where, you know, have you worked in retail? Have you been a waiter? You worked in customer service. Have you, you know, that's something that they would like consider a deal killer in hiring somebody. If you haven't worked in those areas in some, that's a real easy cheat code for like at least the potential of that quality being there. And if you've never done that, never had a job, that's a little bit of a red flag you need to explore more if they're not capable of that or driven to that.
Yeah. Well, you know, have you made something? You know, I remember interviewing somebody who had made an oven for baking bread in their yard. They'd like gone out and got terracotta bricks and built an entire terracotta oven just to make bread. I was like, you know, you're on the team. Like, that's the kind of cool stuff we want. We want you to get your hands dirty.
100%.
And I think it's easy to filter people out because we didn't use this one in particular, but we use similar kinds of things where if you send a car to go and pick them up and then the driver is in on it and they tell you how they get treated, like, is
whatever's
chatty and nice, or did they treat them like, you know, as if there was some kind of lowly service person? I mean, you're in the service industry. You like, you gotta love the services. You gotta have a lot of respect for that. So there's ways to do that. We can talk about that. So I don't want to kind of get stuck on any one of these tactical things. Okay. So the other part of a team is, where are they located? This is a really important thing. And yes, I know we're living in a remote, distributed, hybrid environment now, but I wouldn't start an agency that was remote. I just wouldn't. I like, this is, could be a deal killer. Somebody might be listening to this and they're like, oh, I'm going to turn this off. Like, I know Richard's full of shit. He doesn't know what he's talking about. But I am huge on culture. I think culture eats fucking everything. And I will go to my grave on that. And I think that culture happens in a physical space. At least if you can create that regularly, it doesn't have to be every single day, but on a generally there's a physical space that we can get to. Now, this is the second thing that's going to piss people off. I don't think you should do it in a big city either.
Mm.
Like big city.
Yeah.
Secondary, tertiary cities,
right.
Towns.
Yep.
I actually prefer to be on the boring end of the spectrum. Like when we always were in the suburbs.
Yeah.
I mean, we started in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
To be clear, outside of Boston. Not in Boston.
But we got out of Cambridge, Massachusetts pretty quickly because there was too many things going on. It was too sexy. There were too, the talent competition was extremely high.
Yep.
You're paying, a premium just to have people.
Yeah.
Then those people have to live in those areas or commute into those areas. And it's actually, again, we can talk about that separately. I'd love to circle back on that. We'll come back to that. But a somewhat boring location, like a kind of a suburban location that's not too sexy, where – and the reason why is because you want the team to make the rest of the team their people. Like they want to be like, oh, my God, I want to come to work and then I never want to see these people again. I don't want to see these people after 5 p.m. I never want to see them on the weekends. I actually think it should be the opposite. But like, look, I'm going to invest all my time into these people. I want to get to know them. I want to also hang out with them as well. Like maybe we should have a barbecue on Sunday. Uh-huh. Maybe we should play frisbee on the, at the local park together at lunchtime. Like I think those things still matter. And again, it might be somebody listening going like, oh, fuck, you're just an old guy. And like, none of that's the same. And everything. Like, well, fine. I told you this would be an extreme conversation. I really? Told you that. I warned you.
Right.
That this you're is for people who are, this is for people who are absolutely serious about creating a long-term agency that makes fuck tons of money and delivers value to the customers. Yeah. I'm not talking about if you're like, you're trying to spin something up and you're trying to sell it to the next, accumulating agency that comes along.
Right.
There's a lot of agencies that are just growing because they're acquiring talent.
Yeah.
And if you want to do an acqui-hire, that's cool. You do that thing.
But
if you want to create value and you want to do something really interesting and you want to have a fun time doing it, then this is the way to do it.
Right. And this is, you're creating this without constraints in a laboratory. This is not for someone who wants to I don't want to change any members of my team and I don't want to change the way we work. And I don't want to change where I'm located. Now tell me how to be an optimal agency. That's not what this conversation is. That's totally fair. I think you're.
When we're done with the extreme bit, we can come back and see whether
the sound dials around. But this is, you're describing ideal state. You could just do whatever you want. This is the city on a hill.
But what you want to do is you want to try and create a campus vibe,
right?
Like as if everybody's there for the right reasons and they're having fun,
right?
But it's for adults. Like it's campus for adults. It's not campus for drunk kids. It's campus for adults. Like, oh my God, I can't wait to get there. It's fun. Like the suburbs allow you to do that. Like you go outside, you walk around. We had offices on the Charles River. You could just walk up and down the river. You could walk across to the grocery store. It was collegiate. And I like that. Yeah. And I think that that's why colleges work. And that's why it attracts really brilliant, wonderful minds.
Yeah.
That's the same kind of thing I'm trying to create. It's I always imagined that the agency that I ran was an agency where people wanted to be there, not because they were being paid, but because it was a cool place to be. Like it was a sandbox for their imagination. And
filled with brilliant people they love to collaborate with. 100%. It's all those things. It's all those things are incentives to be driven to be there, to want to be there.
Yeah. And by the way, you mentioned the word incentives. I want to come back to that because that's, again, that bigger part of this.
Yep.
So we're still on teams right now.
Yep.
So small team, co-located in a boring location. In other words, like it doesn't have to be downtown sex in New York or London or whatever. It could be anywhere.
Right.
As long as it's cool. And by the way, that allows for the secondary thing, which is if you're going to be there for a long time, your life's going to change. So you might join when you're 20.
Right.
25.
Right.
But then you're going to probably meet somebody and maybe get married, maybe you have kids. And so if you're in the suburbs already, then those people stick around. But the problem with being in the city is that somebody gets married and has kids and says, oh, now I'm like a 2-hour commute away.
Yeah. 100%.
Like there's no ways I'm coming into the office anymore. And then you lose that. So again, you see the logic in my extremeness here is that you're kind of planning for that far out future that others aren't looking at. They're like, oh, I'll never get married. Well, I never had kids. You're like, great. Call me when you're 32.
Right. No.
You know?
Yeah. That's the not for nothing. The quiet thing I don't say out loud a lot is when a lot of owners are scratching their head trying to figure out when and why did my business change so much on a dime. It's like, you had kids. That's almost always the answer. You had kids. And then you wanted to be more time with your kids. You wanted to be less in the office. You don't want to commute into the office. Being at the office was a I have kids. I wouldn't change it for anything. I'm not advocating against having kids. But I think the one thing that people are blind to in a lot of cases, like, my business really changed. I don't know how. It's like, did you have kids? Because that seems to always be the thing that changes everything. And then you're surprised that your business changed when your kids change everything. So I think, to your point.
And that's going
to
happen if you've got 25, 30 people. That's going to happen to everybody at some point. Now, again, there are some people that are not going to have kids.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Yeah.
I'm not trying to parent shame anybody. But the chances are high, extremely high. And the chances are them coupling with other human beings and then moving in together and then wanting to share a place where they can expand, get a dog, get a cat, whatever it is.
Yeah.
You know, have a little garden. Those things are the real, that's adulting. Yeah, I think it's like an inevitability.
It is. And to your point about maybe boring locations versus major metropolitan areas, even if you take your average person, kids, no kids, whatever, if they live in Boston for 12 years, in Boston, if they live in San Francisco for 12 years, they're going to move several times. Every time they do that, it's going to be hard and expensive and really hard. Like, I come back to this, it's fucking hard. Like, finding an apartment in Boston is a goddamn nightmare. In Boston is a goddamn nightmare. So even if you are a single person, but you live there for 15 years and you move four times, it's much easier to move four times in the suburbs. It's much easier to move four times in Ann Arbor, Michigan, than it is to move four times in Boston. It's just for anybody, no matter their life circumstances. It's just, it is harder when the inventory is so precious and dear to change your lifestyle a couple of times over a decade. And you're probably going to change your lifestyle a couple of times over a decade.
Yeah. So what you're starting to see here and what you're catching on to is this theme of this long view. And so when I started Fresh Soil Soil, I said, for the next 10 years, this is what I'm going to do. Come hell or high water. And I'd been jumping around between other things before that and successfully as well. It's not like you can't jump around. I'm just saying I decided that if I was going to make something that had all of the qualities that we're talking about, and we're going to get to some of the other model stuff as well, but all of those qualities, it had to be a minimum of 10 years.
Yeah.
Like, that was what I understood. That was when I went out and interviewed people. That's when I looked at other agencies. That's when I looked at other companies. When I studied the Jim Collins kind of good to great stuff, there was a long-term view. And by the way, I was also, I was really into investing back then, and I was studying Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett. And I was like, oh, these guys are onto something. Like, you know, this whole thing, this like buy and hold thing.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's the mindset, is that you've got to think long term about everything, about where you're going to be, about where the rest of the team are going to be, how long they're going to stay for, how much of a mythology you can create about the organization around that.
Yep.
And then that kind of moves us into the next part of the question, is, or the canvas, which is the model, the business model. So as we've discussed a million times on this podcast, I don't believe in the hourly rate model. I think that it's fraudulent at worst and kind of naive at best. Like, the idea that you think that people are going to be able to track their time accurately and that your client is going to be able to absorb that without any breakdown of trust.
Yeah.
At best, it's naive.
Yeah.
But at worst, it's the wrong incentives. And again, I'm going to come back to this over and over again. I want to talk a lot about the incentives, because I think incentives are everything. And again, I think I might be quoting somebody like a Charlie Munger or something like that. And that is, you know, if you want to see how people behave, just look at their incentives. Just see how they're incentivized, and you'll understand why they're showing up like they're showing up. So for an agency, this is kind of like an obvious statement, but I'll say it anyway. I don't think getting outside investment is a good idea. You should fund it primarily on the income or the revenue that you generate from customers, from your clients. And I don't believe that borrowing money, unless it's borrowing your own money. In other words, you could be borrowing money from yourself or taking a loan or something like that. That's certainly one way to do that. But agencies are uniquely, or service companies are uniquely situated that you can start making money from day one. You can just start charging people for your, for that first meeting. Like, hey, we're going to meet, we're going to do a discovery session, we're going to do a workshop, and it's going to cost you this much money. Yeah. So there is a way to fund the business. Money.
Yeah.
Right there. So it might be obvious to people listening to this, but you don't need a large amount of money to start an agency. And which means, again, back to the time thing, you may need a little bit of time. You may need a couple of years of bumbling around to get the money that you need from those client projects in order to fund the rest of the business. So, you know, if again, think of the investment model. If you're taking money from your limited partners and you are the general partner, then you're incentivized to do whatever they want. They keep coming back to you and saying, yeah, well, what's happening with my money?
Yeah.
And that could also be true. You know, if you think about how, I mean, this is not a perfect analogy, but I'll use it anyway. But with Berkshire Hathaway, they had a separate business to create the money. So to an insurance business in the form of, it may have become Geico, but I think that was the original business that threw up some of the cash that they needed. And then they took that cash and said, well, we're going to go and invest this. And we're going to invest it on our terms. We're like, we don't need other people to be LPs in this. We can just do it ourselves that way. And I think Renaissance did something similar, and Renaissance were like, that was a really, you know, impressive return on investment. But the idea here is not to have outside incentives. All the incentives should be coming from the inside. And that's why you shouldn't take outside money. You also need to get into like really upfront early conversations with the partners and the employees about where that money that you're going to make is going to go. And it should be highly, highly obvious and leveraged and transparent to put all the money that you can back into the business to get it to a certain size. Because agencies grow not because they're acquiring assets, but because they are doing significantly larger projects. And so you want to invest in the things that allow you to get bigger projects, which is the talent, the team that you need, and you're going to need money for that. And then you're also going to want to invest in the things that allow you to gain credibility with your customers. And that's a lot of branding work, like awareness work and stuff like that. And again, we'll talk about the tactical aspects of that, but there has to be an early conversation amongst partners saying, we're going to put almost all the money that we make back into it. So like 51% of all the money that we make goes back into the business. And then, yeah, we'll pay ourselves a salary. But for the first couple of years, we're going to pay ourselves the bare minimum just so we can get through these first few years, acquire the talent. And the incentive there, of course, is that if you're investing in your talent, you're going to get the best talent. And then that best talent is going to want to stick around because they keep getting more and more of that pie. Yep. And then that pie is going to grow in size. And so everybody's winning. Right. So the model there is that you're going to default to reinvesting in yourself. And you're going to spend as much money on the business as possible, because that's going to ultimately allow you to increase the size of that team to that ideal size, and then also increase the opportunity for you to take on bigger projects. Because those multi-million dollar projects can't be done by necessarily one or two people. They have to be done by 10 plus, 20 plus people. And so the way that you do that, again, is to pay people as much as you can and not worry about things like bonuses or profit share. I'm not a fan of that stuff. I don't believe in those kinds of things. I think you should just pay people that are the absolute most that you can pay them at any one time. And because bonuses feel different to me, or profit share feels like, oh, I'm going to get all the money. I'm the owner. I'm going to get all the money. And then I'm going to dole it out to you. Like I'm like the master of the land, the landowner, and you're my serf, and I'm going to like bonus out the money to you.
Yeah.
Whereas if we're all agreed that we're going to invest in the business and we're going to spend as much of that money back on the team, then we're all going to get rich over time. So we're all going to be making as much money as possible. And so this is a good point for me to stop and say, I want to come back to the original question, which I mentioned, or the original thing I said, which I want to come back to, and that was the end of this. So you've got the beginning, the middle, and the end. The beginning and the middle, in other words, oh, we're going to do this for 10 or 15 years. The end is you have to quit while you're ahead. There is no exit strategy. So this is really important for agency owners. A lot of them are like, well, we're going to grow our business, and then in like, you know, 3 years time or 5 years time, we're going to sell it to somebody. Well, that's nice and good for you. But like, I can count on one hand the amount of people who've sold their agency and actually have anything that's like, in fact, I don't know anybody I know who's on like fuck you money, like who's retired on their money. Do you know anybody?
I can think of one person, and I don't know how much I believe their claim that that is the amount of money that they were paid for their agency. This person, who I'm not going to name, is a douche, and it is both equally possible they were paid that much because they're a douche, or they're lying about it because they're a douche. But like, generally speaking, I agree with you. In my experience, knowing people whose agencies have been acquired, whose businesses have been acquired, the reality is much more of an acqui-hire than it is
100%
a real.
So you're more likely to get another job.
100%, right. That
from your acquisition.
Right, that has amazing constraints and requirements over a mind-blowingly stressful three-year period before you can get the hell out. And not all your team makes the cut when you get acqui-hired. And it's a shit show. Like, it is an exit. It is inarguably an exit. But it is not what anybody in their mind's eye imagines when they think of will be acquired. It is not that.
Right. I think the idea of an exit is that you would go from the pan to the dining room table and be sitting at all the food that was being prepared in the fat. But mostly it's you're leaving the pan and into the fire.
100%.
Sorry to screw up the metaphor, but I'm yet to meet a single person who made so much money selling their agency that they never have to work again. And like, I think I know who you're talking about. The people that claim that, they're either lying or there is some kind of earnout that was required from them that was not worth the price.
Right, exactly.
That, yes, you may have got a dollar amount that was significant, but I met a guy who his company had been acquired by a very, very large agency group and was about 3 years into being a general manager of like one of the biggest divisions within that. So he had been given this big promotion. And we sat over lunch and he told me that he was resigning the next day and that he would rather like cut his hand off than go back to work for another day. And he was literally leaving and he was going to go and live on the island of Mallorca never, ever, ever be in the design agency business again, because that's how broken he was. Like, he was like, I'm done. Yeah. I don't want to advise. I don't want to see these people. I don't want to know them. Yeah. I am completely shelled out and I don't want to talk about it anymore. So like, I think the key point that I'm trying to make here is that your strategy is to make money over a linear period of time, an increasingly larger and larger amount over a linear period of time. 15 years is my suggestion.
Yeah.
And at the top of that 15 years, you all just agree like, today is the last day, and you literally just stop work and you leave with all the money that you've made.
Right.
And you've all made a lot of money because you're constantly reinvesting that money back into the business. And that business is growing. And by saying I'm investing back in the business, I'm saying like, we're paying more, we're investing into salaries, like salaries are increasing.
Yep.
And there's no bullshit like future profit share or exit strategy where like, hey, if we sell, your options or your shares or whatever will be worth such a thing. That stuff's bullshit. I don't believe that ever works. It may work for like a SaaS company or something else, but it doesn't work for agencies. And so the idea here would be to run your business for about 15 years. And when it's peaking, that's when you just tell everybody, okay, we're done. And everybody walks away with you know, whatever's left in that, this is a couple of million dollars in the bank account, you just share it equally, and everybody decides whether they ever want to work again. Maybe they made enough money. If you're doing a good job taking care of everybody, then you're also teaching them how to preserve their money and not to go and waste it on sports cars and things like that. But over 15 years, especially if they're those critical years, you can make a ton of money and you can invest a lot of that. And essentially, your business becomes its own 401k, where you just keep making bigger and bigger investments into the team. And again, that's why you want a certain size of team. You don't want to get it too big.
Right. Because you don't split it too many ways.
You just got to keep dividing. You know, you just got to keep.
So then,
can you see the cat's at the door trying to get in? I feel like Jay right now. The cat's trying to get in on the action.
So in this model, then, if you are imagining this agency having lived this 15-year journey, is it safe to say that you also imagine the owner doing something next? Like, you're not imagining this as, like, I'm going to go live on a Greek island after I do this necessarily.
I mean, if that's what they want to do.
Right.
Like, the point is, that's not my realm. You know, you're going to read Arthur Brooks or somebody like that to figure out what your retirement looks like. But I'm not in the business of telling people what to do with their time.
Yeah.
In their, you know, their kind of the next chapter. But for me, I was not done yet. I needed to continue to work. I needed to have healthcare for my sick wife and my young kid. And I need to be busy. Like, I'm just not a very useful person sitting around the house. Yeah. So I went back into the corporate world and actually found that all the credibility that I'd amassed during the 15 years that we ran Freshdoll Soil was incredibly valuable in the corporate world.
Right.
I wouldn't say corporate, like we're talking tech corporate.
Big enterprise kind of larger.
Not enterprise, but like, you know, medium sized company, like less than 1,000 people.
That's just right.
And my experience has been very, very valuable to those companies. And so that's one path. You could do that. You could become an advisor or a board member, or there's lots of other things you can do. So that's the model. The model has to be you're reinvesting in this campus-like experience where you're saying this group of people and this way of working and this essentially setting them up for success is the strategy. There is no exit. There's no like, oh, we're going to sell and then you're going to get your money. So why don't you suck this job up for the next 10 years? Like, there's a false promise at the end of it.
Right.
And that's what I'm hearing a lot is like agency owners are coming to me and saying, hey, can you help me do this with my agency? If I just do this, this, and this, then I'll be able to sell it. And I'm like, why do you want to sell it? And they're like, well, you know, so I can provide an exit for the people who've been so loyal to me. And I'm like, why have they been loyal to you for now? Well, I promised them that there would be some kind of exit. I'm like,
right.
So you kind of lied to them because you knew that that was like a very, very distant future. You couldn't. Yeah. Those people have like given up the best parts of their life.
Yeah, yeah. But that's back to the Craig model too, right? Like Craig's approach to this would be, this is not do bear this long enough so you have this reward at the end. No, design this in such a way that the reward is all the way through. Like,
exactly.
You're rewarded all the way through. That's why you're here, is because this 10 to 12 to 15 year run is the rewarding thing. It's not eating your vegetables so you can have dessert. It is, no, like living, you know, a quality of life and doing good, all that you're describing. Yeah. But like the reward is throughout. You're not, you know, foregoing the benefit so that you can eventually unlock that. Like that's, to your point, the odds of that are very long.
And we can talk, maybe in another episode, we can talk about the specifics of how you make it worthwhile for people to stick around. Like we made it very easy for people to do projects that they were super passionate about. Like, you know, a certain amount of time was them just like before there was such a thing called design systems, our dev team was like literally building design systems. They were like, how do we solve this future problem that we know that in the next 10 years is going to be a major, major issue. Right. Like we say, go do that. Oh, you want to write a book? Go and do that. Oh, you want a speaking career? Okay, we'll support that. Oh, you want to do this? Like we supported our team in many ways for them to feel like instead of them trying to stuff their LinkedIn profile with bullshit, they were actually learning really, really good skills and laying a foundation for themselves to say, like, yeah, I co-authored a book, or I spoke at these events, or I built a, you know, a foundation model, or I contributed to these things, or, you know, I ran a big community. Like, all of them were involved in something that helped their significant careers, not their like superficial careers. And superficial careers, I mean, like the shit that you stuff into your LinkedIn profile. I mean, like, oh, I've run a $1 million project. I've done these things. Like, one of our project managers, Jane Hetherington, she's now a GM of an agency. And the only way that she was able to do that is because we just kept on giving her whatever she wanted. She would, oh, you want to take on a bigger project? You want to take on more responsibilities? You want to figure out how to get really good at this? We'll do that for you. Like, oh, and by the way, you want to do some other like personal stuff in your life? We'll help you figure that shit out as well. Like, that important stuff is why people stick around. And the mentality there is they don't necessarily think about what job they're going to have next. It's like a very present mindset. Like,
right,
yes. I am present here. Right. I'm not worried about my next job. I'm worried about how do I make this the best possible experience. And so everybody's buying in on that idea. Yeah. Okay, so the last thing I wanted to talk about. So we've spoken about the model and the team, and we now need to talk about the third aspect of this, which is the incentives, which we've kind of mentioned. They're all kind of connected, so they're not separate. But you have to build an incentive model that says, this is a place where you're going to get cared for, where you're going to feel like you're part of something, where you're going to feel like you're growing and evolving, and you're going to get paid the best amount of money that we can possibly pay you. And we're also going to be able to help you build your skills, soft and hard skills, in any way we can. And the incentive there is you need as few leadership roles as possible, because you don't want people to be like distracted by like, well, I've got to manage the politics of getting into the career climbing mode of like, oh, I've just got to get up the ladder. You really want to make everybody feel like, well, there's no bosses here. There's no like, this is much more like the Maverick model or the 37 Signals manager of one model, or there's so many other good ones. There's one called the Amoeba model, which is a Japanese idea. And the idea behind this is you don't want to have like titles and roles that are too fancy, because then people are like, well, how do I climb the ladder? How do I step on somebody's neck? So the incentives, if you really want to get into this, there's a book called Loon Shots, LOONSHOTS, by a guy called Safi Bukal. And there's a model, kind of like an E equals MC squared type elegant model, where you can plug in how many positions are available in your company, how many rewards and bonuses do you provide. Like, all of these things actually screw with the way that people show up for work. Okay. So the more that you bonus people for certain kinds of behavior, or incentivize them for certain kinds of behavior, or provide like tons and tons of career ladders, things for them to do, then what they do, and I think I'm paraphrasing his work here, is that they spend more time managing the politics of work than they actually spend managing work.
Right. If the formula is so complicated, there's so many variables, there's so many moving parts, then they spend a lot of time breaking their brain into all those parts and thinking about all those things. So if it's simpler, then there's less fuzziness and distraction and noisiness. If it's, if there's more operating parts, then you shouldn't be surprised they spend a lot of time daydreaming about the other parts.
Yeah. So if you think about that, then the work that you're doing as an agency, if you want to do the best work and get paid the most money, then you want to be doing the most complicated projects. Like, you're not going to be doing the local laundromat's website.
Right.
Okay. You're going to be doing, your state is going to approach you and say, listen, we need to like rebuild the entire infrastructure for the digital footprint of the state, like how to pay taxes and how to get your dog license and how to pay your parking ticket. Like in my state, it would be like mass.gov, like if you, Valeer was the company that ended up getting that work. And that's like not only the biggest, most complicated project you can think about, but it's also a project that lasts 10 years.
Right, exactly.
Like, you want these kinds of projects. These are these, and the reason why you want these projects is because they pay you a lot of money, and you build a long-term relationship with your customer.
Yes.
So that they keep on paying you money. Like you want that, that is your investment strategy, is you investing in their customer. If you have the kind of business where you're churning through
100%
your clients every 6 months, it's a really, really hard business to stay in. Like it's difficult to do that. Right. So back to your point, the complicated stuff shouldn't be on managing my career and managing other people in my organization. It should be like doing the work. That should be the complicated stuff.
Yeah.
Everything else should be, oh, that's easy. Like it's easy to get along with these people. I like hanging out with these people. It does feel collegiate. It does feel like low stress. I am getting paid a lot of money. So I don't have to worry about that. I don't have to, you know, like prove my value, like, you know, show up and do all kinds of bullshit things just because I want to impress my boss.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the incentives are really important. And again, it should be like a whole podcast just on its own. We can talk about the incentives, but that's the general canvas is the team, the model, the business model, and then the incentives that kind of wrap those two things together. And then the playbook essentially would be, well, how do you put that into action? Well, how do you put that into action from a business development point of view, a marketing point of view? How do you actually structure salaries? How do you do like all of those things? Mm-hmm. And I think those, again, probably another session that we could, this could be part one of five.
It's going to have to be for sure. I love it though. I think that, you know, I want us to be here to tell people things that they don't want to hear in some cases. That is like, why bother with this? If we are just navel gazing and validating, I feel very strongly with a lot of what you described. I align with a lot of that. I think a lot of these things are hard to say to people who, you know, are dealing with a business that behaves certain ways and they don't want to hear these things. And so, yeah, I think this feels like a good medium to say some quiet things out loud.
Well, I want to say one more thing because it's the thing that pulls all this together. So we've spoken about this in the context of a client service business, right? So you've got a team, they're bonded through the fact that they're smart, high EQ people. They're getting paid a lot of money for the work that they're getting doing. They're doing good work. In other words, the incentive is to go and do great projects, not just mediocre shit. All those things. Ideally, you would do one big project at a time as well. Now, people might say, well, that's scary. You can't put all your eggs into one basket. I agree. I don't think that's the ultimate strategy. I'm just talking about the extreme here, is that everybody would be working on one big project at a time. That would be ideal, just because it's easier to do that. Then you don't have like silos and different projects and everything.
Yep.
Reality is you probably need to do, you know, more than one project. It's probably more than one, less than seven, somewhere in that range.
Talking about this kind of team size. Yeah.
Yeah. Depending on the kinds of projects you're going after. But the reason why I mentioned that is because if we were talking about this in the context of a software company, then it would be a single product.
Product.
Right. Yeah. So 20 to 30 people that'd be working on a single product. This is, we talked about this, you know, the first iteration of Pinterest and WhatsApp and Instagram were all like 20 something people. Yeah. And it was ideal. It was one piece of value. The thing is, what happens is the agencies don't do a really good job with the business development part of this stuff. And so they end up benching a lot of people and then they start getting all worried about what they're going to do with these people. So they start to make shit up like, oh, we're going to start a division where we make our own product. We're going to do like a, and now sometimes that can work, but it's very, very, very rare that you can also be your own venture studio.
Yeah.
And also be super successful at it. Again, it does work for some people.
Yeah.
But again, when we turn the dial up to 11 and we be extreme here, you would have one team, one project at a time, all working together with this, like literally a single code base, single design base, all looking at the same stuff at the same time. And the reason why you would do that is because there's a massive efficiency in that. Right. Let's say you had a $1 million project. You could do, if you had 20 people, you could do that $1 million project in far less time than you had committed to. Yeah. And then that means that you can also make a lot more profit. So if you're doing metrics like revenue per employee and things like that, which I think are necessary but insufficient, then you will be making a lot more money if you take that approach. Like if you essentially under promise and over deliver. You're like, look, this is going to take us 6 months, and you do it in 5 months. You got a, essentially a month of revenue for free.
Right. Yep.
Which you can either do nothing. You can all take time off and
right.
You know, go to the Maldives, or
when you invest in internal projects. You don't do internal projects in the hope that it becomes a revenue stream that keeps your agency alive. That's when that's a mistake.
Yeah. And that's what I'm saying. This is an extreme version, right? I'm not saying that there isn't a place for that in the world. What I'm saying is I prefer not to have any distractions. And so if you're really focused, then you're not thinking about, oh, do I have time for that side project? What you're thinking about is, oh, we're all doing this work so we can get it done as quickly as possible. Kind of the weird metaphor is like, it's like the UPS guy with a van full of deliveries to make. And the sooner that he can get the deliveries done, the sooner he can go home. Right. Same kind of model. It's like, the sooner you can get this work done, then the sooner we can like all distribute that money and then enjoy the fruits of our labors and say, yeah, now we're all going to take a week off or 2 weeks off and have downtime, have reflective time, have time where we can start to think about, you know, what's coming next. Obviously, the business development people should be doing that already, but there should be moments, again, to use Craig Bryant's idea of these thin slivers, but there should be like micro slivers of retirement within your year that you can say, yeah, this is not just vacation time. It's like nobody's at the office. Like there's something, you being on vacation, knowing that everybody else is at the office, is very different from
it's a holiday, everybody's off. Yes.
Yeah. Then you're not checking email. You're not worried about those Slack messages.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I spoke over you, but.
But this was very exciting stuff. I appreciate you using this as a forum for this. I'm excited to talk more about it. Obviously, this has to be, you know, a couple parts here. We're going to have to like chop this up over a couple of conversations. I do think similarly, though, it'll be interesting once we interview more people and continue with that part of the podcast, like cutting them into this will be very interesting too, to have this kind of framework to run by them based on their personal experience will be an interesting kind of question we get to ask some folks as we, you know, continue to interview more of our colleagues and people in the industry.
Yeah. You know, we'll find out, for instance, if, because what we are finding out, which I think is that some of the data that we're getting already from our interviews is that in that period between 10 and 15 years, the owners of the business are going to hit that rocky patch of either their lives have changed so significantly, they got married, their kids, whatever, or they just lose, they burn out and they lose the mojo for the business.
Right.
And so I think that number isn't just there as a, hey, this is what the team needs in order to be successful. I think it's also realistic in terms of like life periods or seasons in which you can be really productive, because I think beyond that, being productive for 15 years is very, very, very difficult. Like it's a hard, hard thing to do. Owning your own business, running your own business, being part of a small team that's producing high quality, credible projects and doing that consistently, fucking hard, man. And it's like, I don't know if you can do that forever. So I think it's not just good for the business model, but I think it's actually just good from the perspective of like, it's good for life. It's good for human beings not to have to push themselves that hard.
Right. But and I think similarly, though, if you also have kind of a cap in mind that I intend to do this for 12 to 15 years, having some vision of how far away the finish line is helpful, too. Like, you can imagine doing this for that much. If it's endless, if there's no intended end, if there's no like imagined end, if there's no like then, you know, you don't know how hard to swim. If you don't know how far out you have to swim back again.
There's actually really good research on this. When I used to do this talk where I'd go around the country and I'd talk to teams about comparing high performance teams to teams that were unhealthy and like what the things were. And I was really fortunate that I got an introduction to the Red Bull performance group. So there's a group on the East Coast and on the West Coast, and their entire job for Red Bull is to work with Red Bull athletes to help them do better. And one of the exercises they do is exactly what you just described, is they get a group of multidisciplinary athletes. So it could be a skier, a cyclist, a runner, a paraglider, like it doesn't really matter. And they say, okay, we're each going to give you a bicycle and you're going to ride up this hill. And we're not going to tell you where the finish line is, but you got to ride as hard as possible. So you got to try and do this distance as quickly as possible.
Right.
And so they do that, and then they come down, and there's no like, oh, this is where the finish line was. So you don't know. You got to the top, and maybe the finish line was halfway up or something.
Gotcha.
And then you come down, and you rest for half an hour, whatever. Mm-hmm. You get a Red Bull, and and then you do it again. Except this time they say this is exactly where the finish line is.
Yeah.
And obviously everybody performs better on the second go. They're like, they know exactly how hard they need to push themselves for that finishing line. Yeah. And that is the reality of high performance or healthy teams, is that they know where they're going and they know how long they need to push themselves. And so they pace themselves. And so, again, I talk about this separately, but it's part of this conversation. And that is, business is an endurance sport, not a sprint. Like, there are businesses that are sprints. Like, you can spin up a brand and you can sell it. Like, I think my favorite version of this is, it's called like the tinned water, death water, or something like that.
Hmm.
That brand came out.
Oh, shit.
What is that?
I can't think of what it's called, but I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah. They got like the skull on it and it came in a big can. Yeah. And it was just water. But it was done by a branding guy, and he built that business up and sold it for like $150 million or whatever. Like, yeah, that's just like there are versions of that where you sprint something up and then you sell it. But if you're going to be in a client service business, you actually have to be an endurance athlete. So you've got to think about, hey, how am I going to sustain this? Can I do this for 10 or 15 years? Because that's how long it's going to take to ramp that up and then make that money. And at the end of the day, it's like what my buddy Bobby Glazer says, he's far smarter than I am. He's been running client service businesses, and he just sold his big, big client service business to a PE firm. And so he was going through that same kind of thing as well. And he says, look, if you're going to do anything, have the long, slow, boring business that makes money every single year, then the business that makes no money with the hope that you're going to exit one day.
Yeah.
Because one is predictable and the other one is not. And the one is, you can take that money and reinvest that into the market and get 12, 13% back every single year compounded. Whereas that one that says, hey, you need to win this.
Yeah.
And none of these things are in your control. And then, by the way, that money doesn't compound. It's just like, it's basic. You know, I hate to say it, like it is Charlie Munger's, like, it's easier to be less stupid than to try and outsmart the market.
Yep. Yes, sir. All right. Let's end it there.
Okay. All right. Okay.